Blake Murphy is here. I don't know how often you're going to be here with this Raptors season. I got to tell you, it's...
Guess what? The way it looks right now, Jay-Z is not going to be any better. Our friendship is going to have to shift back to beers and concerts instead of work relationship.
It's actually quite astonishing that somehow the Raptors are so putrid that they're probably making you clamor for the return of Jay Stock.
Yeah.
Like,
Here's the biggest difference is like the Raptors are obviously bad in a way that we kind of expected, but they're uninteresting bad.
Yeah.
At least like,
I was just talking about
the Jays wildly underperforming expectations is at least like intellectually interesting. What went wrong? Do they need a front office change? Yeah. Those kind of things. This is just like, well, it's bad and it's what you signed up for and you can nitpick why and the degree to which some of it's bad, but like, this is it. You're one calendar year into the rebuild, and this is, you know, ideally it doesn't last that long. There are some teams who are in, like, year seven of this. It's
Well, that was the depressing part for me yesterday. So, as you noted, I did some math yesterday. I buckled down.
This is how bleak things are.
I buckled down and did some simple addition, and I thought, okay, it's been the Christmas break, right? I'm not grinding games during the break the way that I normally do. We got the World Juniors during that time. The Leafs still
more
play.
More disappointment.
Well, there's college football. Yeah. There's NFL playoffs getting close to it. Like, you know, there's Christmas Day NBA games. The Raptors didn't populate my holiday sports diet the way that, say, those other things did. Right? I'm checking in and I'm seeing them getting routed. And I'm like, I'm good on this. Like, I watched some of the Knicks game that was close. I watched the Celtics game.
It was close until it wasn't.
Yeah, exactly. The Celtics game, there's like a few in there that I was like, okay, I'm kind of passing in on this. I recorded the first two games of Quickly Back, which, you know, they browbeat the Brooklyn Nets. Congrats. Who are running out as tanky of a team as you can possibly be.
Yet still beat the Bucks team that routed the Raptors last night somehow. Yep. Ben Simmons might be like, at this stage, the worst player in the NBA.
It's quite something watching him.
He's definitely the worst player in the NBA who was at one point good.
Well,
it's pretty remarkable.
Well, it's especially interesting because that team is genuinely, like, they are going full throttle with their tank.
Yes.
And
it's just a matter of trading Cam now if he can get healthy in time for the deadline.
For sure, but you watch them play, and when Ben Simmons is on the floor, it doesn't feel any different than when any of the other guys are on the floor, and you go, that's not good. We have a producer here, no joke, whose favorite player is Ben Simmons.
His favorite basketball player?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I know. Has a jersey. And that's when you know, like, again, when I make fun of these guys and people are like, oh, are you hard on your producers? It's like, no, that's what they do. It's like they're the types of guys that put DeRozan on the back of a baseball jersey and cheer for Ben Simmons.
Funny jersey aside.
Yeah.
And you get it because it's Rutgers. But someone sent me a photo from the Rutgers game yesterday. Yeah. Obviously, Harper and Ace Bailey. A Ron Harper Jr. Raptors jersey in the crowd.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very like Roberto Luongo Leafs.
Oh.
Remember? Like when people jump the gun on those things, I'm always like, now it's never going to happen.
He was on the roster as a two-way for like 8 minutes.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Not Dylan Harper.
I thought you were thinking Dylan Harper jersey.
No, like Ron Harper Jr.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. No. Well, that was probably a family member.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I would guess.
To wear the Raptors version when he signed with the Pistons the other day.
Yeah.
Is that maybe you just couldn't get your Pistons Ron Harper Jr. jersey at the time. I love the deep cut jerseys like that you see at college basketball games where it's like, I'm not an NBA fan.
Yeah.
I'm such a big Rutgers fan that I'm going to get the jersey of my guy.
Yeah, I actually do appreciate that.
Yeah,
like that,
no,
that is
it's
something
sick. It's
to
a
me.
Cool, well, cool it's form like, of fandom that we don't really get as much here.
No, the closest thing I've ever had to it, I would say, is that I cheer for the Washington Huskies as a byproduct of losing the Seattle Supersonics and going, well, I need to have a Seattle-based basketball team. So right as I was really getting into the Huskies, Isaiah Thomas became the star point guard of the Huskies, and he won a Pac-12 championship with a buzzer beater famously called by Gus Johnson. Cold-blooded, which is immediately cemented me as like an Isaiah Thomas guy forever, right? Loved Isaiah Thomas, became Mr. Irrelevant in the draft, and then goes on to have like a really successful career that I tracked. And there was a brief moment where I considered getting an IT, like NBA jersey, and then he became a Celtic, and I was like, well, there goes that dream.
Yeah,
you know, there goes that dream. We will not be purchasing any Boston Celtics memorabilia. Anyway, to your point about the Raptors and just kind of being uninterested.
Oh, the math you did, that they've been outscored by 219 over the last 14 games or whatever it is.
I just want people to appreciate the depth of that number. 219 points, point differential, over 14 games where they've won one game. And yes, I'm fully aware that the Raptors have been missing quickly for out of those 14 games, 11 of them, that this isn't a team that's been the bastion of health. They've had RJ Barrett out of the lineup. They've had Jakob Poeltl out of the lineup. They've had Scotty Barnes out of the lineup for some of those games, even though the vast majority of those, he's actually been healthy. I just, watching them last night, I have some concerns that I think, yeah, go ahead.
So here's the way to contextualize that 219 number. So over the last 14 games, they've been outscored by 219 points total. I pulled all these the other day because when they lost the Celtics game, it was the worst outcome ever. It was the worst 2-game stretch, 3-game stretch, 4-game stretch, 6-game stretch, etc. So the only time that they've done worse than 219 point differential over a 14-game stretch was last year when they went on the 15-game losing streak late in the year and Malik Williams was starting at center. I think the best way to contextualize it, though, is this stretch is by point differential and win-loss record safely worse than any stretch during the Tampa tank, where it was called the Tampa tank, unofficially by the team. And they were like, there was a game where Daniel Oturu, Juwan Morgan, and Tremont Waters were the bench.
I got to tell you right now, there is 0% chance
Aaron Baines,
I would have gotten any of those.
Aaron Baines started at small forward.
Yeah.
For those teams. And this stretch does not, like the Tampa season does not have a stretch that touches this one.
Yeah, that's really bad. And especially if we want to add further context, the Raptors are in a rebuild, okay? And the Raptors fans, I think, are satiated to a certain degree. I know that I am in terms of an interesting draft this year, right? There are three guys at the top of the draft, maybe 3.5, 4, depending on how you feel about the kid at BYU. That will make you feel pretty excited about the future of this organization, or more, at least more optimistic about it if they're able to land there. It's been pointed out by many, and so, you know, it feels redundant to mention that it's not a guarantee. This isn't the NFL where you lose these games and you're the Patriots who bomb out of a spot, or you're the Jaguars.
Yeah, who beat the Titans in a must-lose game in Week 17.
And especially since that got... That didn't get discussed enough because the Bills did the right thing of tank the game with their divisional opponents so that they don't get the asset.
Yeah.
And the Jaguars couldn't be bothered to have the same kind of mentality. I'm going to ask you a little couple Jaguars.
Oh, yeah. Raptors isn't painful enough. We got to talk Jaguars too.
Yeah, let's do Raptors, Jaguars, Blue Jays. I'll just bring you.
Ninth head coach in 15 years. Let's go.
But here's the problem. The Raptors rebuild is one where the core is locked up. This was always the issue. This is something that you and I addressed at the outset of the season of, well, how do you really judge a tank season that is not really meant to be a tank season? How are you supposed to interpret games like last night where you can turn it off after the second quarter? Like, it's halftime, and there was absolutely no way that they were going to get in that game. And I'm going to start with this part of it, which is, where are we even looking for successes? Because to me, this is far beyond just like a chemistry issue of not having these guys all play together.
Yeah, and that's like a part of it, but they're all professional basketball players who are supposed to be starting caliber players in the NBA. Like, absolutely you run this action, it swings to the other side of the floor, you run this action, and then guys miscommunicate a little bit on like the third step in that sequence. Sure, that's the stuff you need lots of reps to play together. You roll the ball out to start the second half, and it's so bad that you have to make a substitution before the 2-minute mark because guys aren't locked in. You have 3 backcourt turnovers in a 2-minute stretch of play between the end of second quarter and the start of third quarter with 4 of your starters on the floor. That is the kind of stuff. You don't need chemistry to know the over and back rules. You don't need chemistry to come out of halftime with a little bit of energy after you just got your
2
teeth
over
kicked
and backs
in. And then they start the
succession.
Second half with one.
Yeah.
Like that is not chemistry stuff. Yeah. It's, hey, I misread this guy's timing on a pocket pass. Hey, I thought he was going to lift out of the corner and he didn't, so I threw it. Like, that's the little chemistry stuff. Not we came out and got run off the floor at halftime, came out of half with no energy whatsoever. pulled the plug on the game with 7 minutes left. Like, that's not chemistry stuff. So, yes, one of the things that I'm watching is how, like, the main six or seven guys look together. It's important information. They'd only played 4 minutes mm-hmm. together before last night. Even if you take, you know, Grady, or if you take Jakob out of that question, you know, those guys had only played 18 minutes together, the BBQ and Grady Dick. You know, I want to see how Jacoby looks in there and Ochai off the bench and things like that. All those things are important.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the way things have gone the last couple weeks is such a far cry from how they were playing energy and intensity wise and doing the little things wise when they didn't have all this help. They didn't have all these guys mm-hmm. here. And I don't think, you know, this is certainly not a team with enough established guys that you should be able to do that. Oh, well, we're healthy now. And we just kind of overestimated ourselves and didn't have our foot on the gas. Like, this team's only, even if at the start of the season, had they been healthy, I think I picked them for 35 wins if they were healthy. Mm-hmm. That would have required this group to play like the injured group was playing 4 weeks ago when every loss was a cool 5-point loss. You know, you need Jason Tatum doing the Fred Flintstone toe tap to beat you. Like, you need this team to play that way. Otherwise, I don't know what you're taking from this. And to your point about like these guys are a little further along timeline-wise, it's like, yeah, this is what a rebuild looks like results-wise. But if you're RJ Barrett and you're in year six, and I don't want to hang it on RJ because he, you know, first night back last night, he was the only guy who had it on offense. But like RJ Barrett as example, this is year six in the league and you're on your second contract. IQ, you already got paid. Scotty Barnes, you already got, the max hasn't kicked in yet, but you already got it. And this is one of the challenges with this is it is a rebuild. And we can all intellectually understand that 8-28 is part of the plan. But as we're evaluating these guys, the runway isn't the same as if Scotty and RJ and Quickly were all on their first contracts, like a traditional rebuild, right? Yeah. Like the Pistons are feeling the timeline this year because Cade's max is about to come in and they've spent a little bit in free agency and this is year four.
Well, and they've taken a step.
Yeah. Yep. And that's, you know, and I'm not saying the Raptors should be where the Pistons are because that wasn't the plan this year, but the page will turn and how we evaluate them is going to turn pretty quickly. And I think, you know, this is a separate topic, but if the reports out there that they are not interested in trading Jakob Poeltl are true, that tells you pretty firmly that they intend to be good again by next year. Mm-hmm. So that's where like a game like last night gets really troubling where it's like, man, if you intend to be good, if you don't intend to be good next year, why do you have all these guys like on their next contracts and why are you paying everybody already? And why isn't Jakob Poeltl available? If you do intend to be good by next year, man, you got to nail these next 50 games because it doesn't look good right now.
That's what I am having a tough time reconciling is, okay, I don't want to be overly critical of last night in particular, right? Because I'm going, all right, even in the context of the 14 games, you've got three with Quickly, right? But I'm texting these guys last night, like my producers. There's a famous clip of Kobe Bryant talking about modern day basketball. And I'm an old guy, and so I love that stuff, right? Like, even though I couldn't stand Kobe during his career, now, anytime somebody sends me a mama mentality clip or a Kobe clip, I'm like, yes, hell yes. Even though I remember him just like berating teammates and, you know,
refusing to pass or refusing to shoot the ball for a half to stick it to Smush Parker.
Well, I was going
to
say that Kobe's, the look backs on some, bless you, on some of his things, like how, you know, he was always making the right choice where it was like, you were also a volume shooter. Like, there were some things with Kobe's game too. He has this quote about accidental basketball where it doesn't feel like there's a real structure with the team, that it's a lot of drive and kick, and you're just kind of hoping that a guy ends up open. And watching last night's game, I couldn't help but feel like, all right, it's probably going to take some time before we can properly evaluate what we're seeing with this particular group of guys. But to the, you know, the flip side of that is people have taken their small sample sizes of good numbers and propagated them and been like, oh, well, look at these guys when they're together. They're pretty awesome if they could just stay healthy. And I watched yesterday and I can't help but come away with the feeling of like, they don't really fit. Like, they don't look like they're running offensive sets that have real purpose. When it was Jakob Poeltl and RJ Barrett, you were like, okay, the Raptors' primary function here is to have these two guys in a screen and roll with shooters around them to, you know, help create and move the ball around. There was kind of a bit of execution with what was happening with the ball movement. Right now, watching them like take turns between RJ Quickly and Scotty Barnes in terms of who's bringing the ball up, who's starting the actions, And watching where the ball ends up, it was the epitome of just accidental basketball, where every play felt like, okay, I guess they got that look, but it didn't look as though that was something that was kind of derived with purpose.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. And like, obviously, reintegrating quickly is, even though he is someone who, like, that should be a floor-raising skill set, right? Like, we saw it in the Nets game, 15 assists, one turnover, everything looks a little more organized. Mm-hmm. You have gone from playing basically the whole season without a point guard mm-hmm. to now you, oh, the offense has a point guard, and we're going to run some pick and roll and things like that. So there's a reorienting in that way. RJ is the guy who I think his role is changing the most here, like, yeah. and he can still get his buckets, but RJ is probably, whether it's fair or not, going to slide back at least somewhere between what he's been this year and what he was with the Knicks in terms of like, okay, it's RJ's turn now.
I was just going to say,
or swing it to the second side.
He's fascinating with this because it's like, we know what he is ceiling wise. And I've made this point many times. Like, he is kind of the perfect tank guy because he can go out there and get you 25 to 30 points and it can look pretty entertaining. And he will get some others involved, but when it gets to crunch time, and it's like defense is tightening up and shot selection becomes far more important, you start to really see the flaws of his games. So through the first 1 through 3 quarters, you're like, man, is RJ Barrett an all-star? And then quarter four, you're like, oh, I see what this is. I can understand what's going on here. And yet, like, asking him to be the guy that has to sacrifice the most, given the season that he's had, is also a little bit of a complicated issue. It's not smooth.
It's also complicated in that, like, he's the hometown guy and the guy who's taken on the vocal leadership role and mm-hmm. stuff like that. He's also, of all the core guys, the guy on the shortest contract. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking at, you know, who doesn't fit or what doesn't fit, I'm not saying they're going to shop RJ or anything like that, but, like,
I think eventually,
you look at
though,
what the cap sheet looks
it,
like, yeah, and, yeah. like, the other guys are you know, around longer, especially when you factor in like restricted free agency and stuff. So yeah, I think RJ is the guy who's gonna have to sacrifice right now. I have a little more patience on the offensive end to like see, you know, again, you're reintegrating quickly. Probably the thing I care most about the rest of the way offensively is like, Quickly and Barnes looked really good together in that Brooklyn game.
Yeah.
Every time they hit the floor together between when Quickly was acquired and that game, they did not look like they'd ever really played together before. Like, there was not a great chemistry there. On paper, that should be a good 1-4 pick and roll combo, right? Like, we saw mm-hmm. Scotty do a really good job getting into the paint in that Nets game. Yesterday was more like, hey, mid-range, post-fade kind of stuff. But you can orchestrate some of that stuff better when he doesn't have to play point guard. So I think there's, you know, I have some patience for that to come along,
sure.
but it's going to take RJ some time. In terms of the offensive play design, like, they get to, this is a positive, eventually they get to use Grady like a shooter now instead of like yeah. your number one scorer.
It's better, but when, like, he doesn't start 1 of 7 or whatever.
Yeah, he's looked uncomfortable yeah. so far, and it should, you know, in theory, those should be easier. That should be easier shot diet and time, but that's all going to take it some time. Mm-hmm. I have more concern on the defensive end where, you know, mm-hmm. I like Ochai. He's not like OG Anunoby defensively. And like, it's not like this team has been good defensively. And it looks like the difference defensively when he comes off the floor mm-hmm. and you've got Quickly, RJ, and Grady Dick as your three perimeter defenders.
Who all get beat off the dribble with quite the relative ease.
Yeah, like Scotty is good, but he can't guard everyone. Like, yeah. you needed him on Giannis last night. You can't
Jakob
really.
Pertl is good for what he does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so that's going to be a challenge with that group. And I don't know. Offensively, I have patience with it. You can play design, you can build chemistry and stuff mm-hmm. like that. Defensively, if Quickly is not as good defensively as advertised from New York, within that Tibbs system, then what this looks like, or at least what the starting lineup looks like, is gonna be interesting. I have much more concern on that end of the floor. Offense, I have a little bit more patience for just.
I would say, you know, I kind of agree with you in the sense of,
I'm not saying it's going to be good tomorrow. I just, like, I'm yeah. willing to wait it out a little bit offensively.
For sure.
Defensively, I don't see the path to them being good with this core.
I can't indict what they are as a group on the offensive end based on the sample set we have. It should also be noted, though, like, you know, being available is a skill. And yeah. even in a year where they're probably being a little overly cautious with certain injuries, and guys have played quote unquote banged up, which to me is kind of a little laughable, to be honest, because I think the Raptors are in a state where if Barnes was really dealing with anything of consequence, he'd be sitting down.
Also, they were playing yeah. the fatigue card after yeah. like the easy, like they played seven times in 22 days because
yeah,
of the NBA Cup.
It was Team Canada's junior team not being able to practice, where they're like, oh, they're too tired. They slept in the hotel down the street and they're too tired from showing up from OHL teams that were down
the Americans
road.
Had a totally different schedule. Czechia had a totally different schedule.
Outrageous. So I am more optimistic about where they can land offensively.
Yeah.
But to your point that I do agree with is like when I see the defense, I don't know how it's going to work with these guys.
And like,
I don't see how this group of players is ever going to be anything but a negative defensively.
And like Scotty's really good defensively. Jakob's really solid defensively.
Is a problem defensively.
So far, yeah.
He will always be a problem defensively.
And like I have to mea culpa on this one because I like this defense in New York. And like obviously it's tough to be like, okay, well, you're 25 minutes off the bench and you're in a system-oriented thing. And like, okay, well, Jalen Brunson can look okay in that system. So maybe, you know, there's a transporting of that skill set problem that, you know, maybe I wasn't fully ready for because I thought he was at least solid defensively. He hasn't been that yet.
And, no.
And like, you can have good defenders off the bench. Like, I think Bobo's going to be a good defender. Shed's a good defender. Ochai's a good defender.
Sure.
But like, what are you going to do? Close games with three bench guys? Like, it's not realistic. So this is where like, you get pretty quickly to like any draft. Obviously, if you get the number one pick, you're going Cooper Flagg. Mm-hmm. But anywhere after that, you really got to weigh the defensive side of the ball with what you're doing there too, which is tough because like you probably also want someone that has number one creator ceiling, and they're only not even in a really good draft. There aren't a handful of guys who are going to be like top end difference makers at both ends. So
it's going to be. I would say this like so quickly. I feel like people probably just think like I'm just a pure hater of his game, but I hate the contract. I've made no reservations about that. I think that he got drastically overpaid, and even in a league that a lot of guys get really overpaid, you look at the number compared to. I made this comparison with Michael Grange. He hated it, by the way. So, but you look at how people evaluated Zach LaVine's contract. And how it's like, oh, it's an unmovable thing. And just the landscape of what the salary cap is and trades and all these different elements of making it more and more difficult to move off of a guy. I was thinking last night watching him, like, what happens if they did get Dylan Harper? And
oh, you're fine.
Yeah, but you have quickly and you're like, wait, what is the...
Hang on. Here's the thing. You watched last night's game.
Uh-huh.
You cannot immediately swing to too many good players is a problem.
It's not too many good players.
No,
I'm just saying that they already have three guys that are bringing the ball up the floor quickly already feels like the guy that has suffered the most in terms of that lack of chemistry, that lack of play, that lack of fit.
I think you would be fine. You have to put it on him then and be like, look, man, we got Dylan Harper. He's 6'6". He has a nose for the rim that you don't have. Like you
hey, guess where you're going? Back to being the sixth man.
Or we're going to, because like Harper's 6'6" and like should project to be able to defend twos pretty capably. Like you could get to, hey, IQ, you're just going to run off the ball a little bit more. Like you're going to be, you know, hey, we have Grady spacing out. You're going to be the guy doing the screener and then flaring out. You're going to be, you know, off the ball just a little bit more. You'd want to, I mean, he'd be a rookie, so you'd want Harper, you know, able to slot into that RJ role, attack on the second side and stuff like that. I think you'd be fine. I'm just like, I have zero concern right now
about them adding guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've had some people, and I don't want to like call anyone out, but like people be like, they have to trade RJ, like Jacoby and Jamal Shedder there. I'm like, cool. Like Jacoby, like Jamal, maybe at some point before his contract's up, you will explore. But the reasoning for trading RJ is not, you have the 8-28 team has too many good players.
I was going to say though, it's funny too, with people projecting certain guys going like, well, you have these two guys and you're like, why are they 1-14 1-13 in their last 14 games?
I'm like, look, I like some of those guys as future rotation guys. But yeah, the justification for any move right now cannot be, oh, there's too many good players.
Well,
you wouldn't be 8-28.
There has been some positivity in terms of when Mobo's been in, he's shown, I think, a bit more than a traditional guy that's taken in his draft slot.
And he's going to get a good chunk of G League time now that they're a little healthier. And like, obviously people would rather see him in the rotation, but you think back to like how those stints have helped like Siakam and Fred and Norm and DeLon and those guys. Hey, go down here for 5-6 games, play 30 minutes a game, be the guy a little bit more. And kind of like that mid-season reset, it'll be good for them for the second half.
Well, where I was going with that, though, is like they've had some individual successes, I would say. Like there's been stretches of Grady Dick's play where we're like, oh, damn, this looks really good. We've seen stretches of RJ's play that's been really positive. Jakob, there's been a bunch of these guys that Shed and Mobo and go on down the line where they've had some real flashes of, oh, this is actually, this might be a rotation guy. That's nice. But how are you evaluating Darko at this point? Like, what are you seeing that are markers of success? And I guess what would you say is, if anything, is really troubling you?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the markers of success are like guys are still saying the right thing and I don't know. There's nothing like really like when they were playing in all those close games and yeah, the end of game execution stuff was not there. But you could really point to, well, they're in all these games, they're playing over their heads, they're injured and they're still giving a good effort and stuff like that. I'm a little concerned over the last couple of weeks, not the concern level of, you know, after every game, everyone's tweeting at me if they should fire. I'm like, that's not realistic about where they are in the build or anything like that. You know, we had a good chat with Garrett Temple on the show last week and I straight up asked him, I'm like, how, like, what signs are you seeing that I can't see from outside that guys aren't letting go of the rope? Cause you just got like walked off the floor in three straight games at this point. This was right after the Nets game, but I was talking about the Wolves game and and the Celtics game. And I was like, what are you seeing that we can't see? And he said, you know, it was little things like how guys are engaged in the film work, what they're doing in practice, the attitude and stuff like that. So cool. But we can't see that stuff from outside. It looks like four or five times in the last six or seven games, this team has come out flat and you haven't been able to push the button to get guys, you know, fired back up. And even if you're overmatched, you shouldn't lose games by 24 against a Bucks team down a starter that just lost to Brooklyn and Portland. You shouldn't lose by 55 to anyone. If I asked Matt Bonner to go play one-on-one later, if I lost by 55, I'd be like, damn, I played poorly today. So I don't know. Those things are concerning. I shouldn't say I don't care. Everything is information right now. Obviously, that stuff's important. I'm not as concerned about some of the late game stuff because, again, it is what it is. And maybe you're, you know, focused developmentally. Like, even the rotation stuff right now, it's like, okay, well, are you playing that guy because you think it's your best chance to win? Are you playing that guy because it's development? So that stuff, like, the context there is real. Mm-hmm. But I am concerned at the swing from we're going to play a bunch of close games where we play over our heads and the effort's there and it looks like we're having fun and it looks like we're an annoying team to play against to we're just garden variety really bad over the last couple weeks. Even understanding the context in that part to me is concerning because there's a big difference between, hey, we're rebuilding and there are going to be some bumps in the road to, hey, we're rebuilding and our guys are back and we're not competitive unless we're playing against Brooklyn. Like, yeah, I'm not like sounding the alarms, but I don't know how you're not concerned that, you know, the stuff that we can see, the way that we can try to feel out energy and effort and attention to detail and stuff like that. The fact that it's gone the other way the last couple weeks is, I don't think it's good.
Mm-hmm. So what about Barnes? Because again, an injury plagued season, but when you look at what he's accomplished so far this year, I would say that it's difficult to say that there has been a step taken in any way. Like, he's shooting more threes and he's making less of them. Mm-hmm. His field goal percentage has dipped. His points per game, his assists, like, they've kind of just sort of...
Statistically, it's almost identical.
That's here. What I mean. It's been very plateau-y outside of a little bit, I think, more emphasis of shoot the ball when you're open behind the three-point line. And his coach has been actually adamant about, hey, maybe even add more of that to your game despite it not being very effective. Again, there are caveats to all of this. But ultimately, it has felt a lot at times like, okay, you've handed over the car keys to this guy. He is supposed to be your best player, your franchise player. And regardless of you missing guys and being in a rebuild, I wouldn't say that I've been overly encouraged about the idea that like, oh, wow, there's just like this other, again, flashes where it's like he blocks Giannis yesterday and you're reminded of just like how many guys in the league can do that at his position.
Or strips him and goes for the windmill.
Right. Like he has those flashes where you see it and you go, damn, that's really impressive. But the overall body of work this season, I wouldn't say is one where it's like, damn, it's looking really justified that this is the cornerstone piece or the number one player on a franchise.
Yeah, like I think the max contract is fine, right? Like he's not going to get all NBA this year. So he's like, we'll see if he gets to 65 games. But the number of all NBA team players that come from 20 win teams.
NBA.
It's going to be 25% of the cap, which is totally reasonable for a guy of his level. And I think, you know, statistically, it's basically plateaued, but he's taken on a little bit more of a role, you know, usage wise. So the efficiency even staying even is okay if we're kind of projecting out. You know, part of last season too, half that season he wasn't the number one guy on the opposing team scout, right? Like they had Pascal and OG and even Dennis Schroeder as an organizer and stuff like that for the first half of the season. So you know, maybe his usage was a little easier for the first half of last year, and then he missed a big chunk of the second half. So if we're comparing, and then I think the defensive level is still there. I think he's a really good defensive player. If there's, you know, if there's something that I'm watching, it's look, the threes are whatever. I don't think that player type should necessarily be coming out and taking five threes in the first quarter. Like, I just don't think that's where his, like, I would much rather him be trying to get downhill, be getting in the paint, work those post-up fadeaways and things like that. And then once the defense has to overreact to you because you're so dominant inside, then you open them up
a little bit.
You're the trailer, and they're sagging off you because they're so worried about you getting in the paint. You want to bang a three down then.
And they're not respecting the closeout.
Yeah. Hey, Quickly's back. You're going to work as a screener a little bit more. You want to pop out on some of those instead of rolling and get a catch and shoot. Those are fine. Like, I don't want him to stop taking them generally because it's a developmental season.
No.
But I think the Nets game was a great example. I thought last night was a good example, too, actually, of like, where his real offensive strengths are. And it's that he's stronger than everyone and gets to his position better than everyone. And having a point guard who can, like, he doesn't have to also have the ball as he tries to get himself to the elbow or to the high post or something like that. I think that stuff is really encouraging. The amount he's shooting at the rim being down is probably, and like some of that is in service of the threes, but that's what I hope trends back up. Like, he's taken fewer than 20% of his shots at the rim this year.
Yeah, I hate that.
And the first three years of his career was up around 27. Mm. And that's a pretty big difference when, you know, you look at how Giannis plays, and that's not a fair comp for him because Giannis is, you know, the best in the world at getting to the rim.
Yeah, but it kind of is a fair comp in the sense of people call him baby Giannis sometimes. And if you were to take like the physical player type of what you really want this guy to be eventually, I would say is like a small version of Giannis where he's attacking the paint relentlessly.
Yeah.
And that to me is actually one of the things that I am most concerned about with Barnes is that far too often in a season that is so much about his development and him taking over this team and being, you know, the guy who pushes the pace, the guy who sets the culture of the team, that it's like, where are you around the basket? Like RJ Barrett, again, to your point about how this guy has, when given opportunity, done those things culturally, been the guy who's like kind of setting the tone for where they want to be.
He doesn't finish super well, but he gets
there. But he's attacking there. And I want to see Barnes be like, okay, this is my team. This is my season. I'm going to the rack a lot. Way too many games where it's like he's just a perimeter guy or he kind of takes himself out of it by not being someone who's relentless at the rim.
Yeah, and I think that this is something that, you know, he's got to figure out, but this is part of the like ebb and flow of like growing into a larger offensive role is like he probably likes shooting threes and thinks he needs that as part of his bag to get where he wants to go. And then, you know, you get half a season and you're like, hey, you know what? I'm shooting 28% on threes. And look, I'm shooting 56% on those little, like, hey, I get it on the block, one shoulder into the guy and then fade away. I'm shooting 56% on those, 28% on threes. A little quick math, the twos are worth more. And like it tilts that way. And again, I do think long-term being back will help him get into those spots a little bit more because he doesn't have to. Like one of the standout stats for the Raptors for me this year is they're pretty good on like baseline inbound plays. Mm-hmm. And they're last I checked, they were last in the league on sideline inbound plays. Because they don't have an ability to get downhill. Mm-hmm. And like, even though Scotty is a good downhill player, they lack the like creation and threats that aren't Scotty to get the space or get him with a head of steam going downhill. Whereas once you have a point guard back, you can do that. You can create that stuff a little bit more with Scotty as a screener or doing some different stuff. So I think that'll trend in the right direction, but it's probably like, if we're talking about any individual on the Raptors and any one stat, Scotty's rim rate is the thing I'm probably most looking at the rest of the way, because for him to be a super duper star, yeah, he needs a three-point shot that's reliable. For him to be a star, period, you got to get back to being, not that he hasn't played like one, but like you got to get back to being a guy who really puts a lot of pressure on the rim, because that opens up so much more for him and for everyone else.
That's it. And he's not, again, if we're extending the Giannis comparison, right? What was it, a season ago or two, when Giannis decided like he was going to start overshooting threes?
And now he doesn't shoot them at all. That's become like KD in the mid-range.
Exactly. It's like he had a year where It was a big conversation. Hey, why is Giannis taking so many threes?
His second MVP year, 2019-2020, he took almost five a game. And now he's taking less than one a game.
So I do hope, ultimately, that is the progression of Barnes. That they're like, hey.
I mean, I hope he becomes a reliable three-point shooter, and then you can have both. You can have them both. But
I was like, it depends on what the marker is here reliable. I don't want to see him be a guy who takes six a game, which is where
he settles in as a 28% three-point shooter. Yeah, you can't have him taking six a game.
Yeah, it's just not workable. Yeah,
but again, developmental. I'm okay with six a game is maybe a little high. But
and like Siakam became a much better three-point shooter over his career. Like it has happened.
Siakam also gets something in Indy that Scottie doesn't get in that like. Siakam gets to spot up sometimes.
Well, that was the other part of the Siakam three-point development is he got a long run of just being a corner three-point shooter. Yeah. And then when they finally did start to give him the ball and take those above-the-break threes, and I don't even know where his percentages finished on the above-the-break three versus the corner three because I'm guessing.
Significantly different.
Exactly. That the numbers were quite, there was a large disparity between the two. But Barnes is never going to be a guy who's standing in the corner and knocking out.
He's taken maybe a dozen corner threes.
Exactly. Year. Most of them are above the break, and most of them are the ones that you see last night where he's just like, you can see it. And it's like, he gets a little bit of space and the offense isn't really doing much. And he goes, I'm settling and I'm taking the shot, which again is not killing you when you're in a rebuild season, but something that when I'm looking at it moving forward and trying to say that so much of this year is about him taking the reins and him being the guy, I want to see it be a little bit more purposeful in terms of what the design is for him offensively.
Yeah. And I should just point out too, the last three games, he's only taken 4 3-point attempts. He's taken 14 or 15 two-point attempts in each of those games.
That's nice.
I do think it's trending the right way. Yep. And it hasn't been rim stuff necessarily, but I think for him, given his touch in the 8 to 12 foot range, those I'm going to get on the block and throw it like that.
I like those a lot more.
Yeah, it's not at quote unquote at the rim, but I like those for him. So I actually think the last three games in terms of his shot package has been okay. I mean, I think it's trending in the right direction. And again, some of that is quickly, but that's what I'm watching for.
Okay. So, let's take a break, but I want to come back and ask you what is my kind of biggest question with where this is trending, because the team has been pretty adamant through insiders that Jakob Poeltl is not someone who is going to get traded. So I'm going to outline a few scenarios for you and ask you which one of them makes it more likely that Masai, who is notorious about standing pat, actually does move off of the center. That's next.
All right.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right. So I mentioned it. Masai likes to stand pat. I know he has been aggressive at the last two deadlines. One famously trading for Jakob Poeltl, surrendering a first-round pick.
And two deadlines, he traded for Thad Young.
I took heat from Raptors Twitter saying that I didn't like that trade.
I took heat from Raptors Twitter last year for making a joke when they traded for Kelly Olynyk.
Yeah.
Like, 3 years in a row, first-round pick for a backup center.
Yeah.
Obviously, Jakob's not a backup center, but let me get a joke off once in a while, you know?
So Jakob Poeltl remains to me the most interesting piece of the team when it comes to the trade deadline, which frankly, that's going to be one of the more, there's like a couple of compelling things with the Raptors. One is going to be now that they've got all the guys healthy, what does it look like? And does it start to trend in a positive direction? And that to me is actually paramount compared to the losses. Much as I'm a fan of the tank and was a fan of the tank at the outset of the season and have remained pretty steadfast in wanting the Raptors to tank this year and go after one of those top three picks. Yeah, it's not a guarantee. And what you actually have in front of you with your young collection of players who are on expensive contracts, it's important to find out whether or not they fit together, what pieces are going to be able to take a step, whether they develop, blah, 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 blah. Secondarily is, yes, the losses and them piling up so that you have the extra lottery balls, but also, are you going to be able to make an impact at the trade deadline? And Bruce Brown, who comes in last night, and you're like, all right, Bruce Brown, and looks like a guy who does not care at all about being on this basketball team whatsoever. Kelly Olynyk's name has been floated out there. Another guy to me who I just can't envision a contender saying to themselves that they want to take on his money or find a role for him.
Yeah, I hope I'm wrong on Kelly, but Mark Stein was on our show yesterday and said that there's a market for Kelly for a second round pick or something like that. Okay. And I'm paraphrasing here, but he's said that's one of the names that's been out there. If you get a second round pick and get out of the $13.5 million,
in a heartbeat.
Obviously I love Kelly as a dude and it's cool that he's here, but if you could get an asset and clear $13.5 million off the books for next year?
I think even if you could just clear the $13.5 million off the books next year, you do it for nothing. Like, if that was possible, you would just go, done, done deal. Yeah, maybe he bounces back a little bit from the injury. It's not exactly like he was Mr. Fleet of Foot, but as he's aging, it looks like he's wearing concrete boots. And yeah, even some of the stuff we saw from him last year in terms of what he could do out of the post from a ball movement and scoring standpoint hasn't really been there the same way so far this season.
And it'll come offensively, but it's not going to come defensively.
Yeah, just again, if I'm a contender, like, show me the spot where he makes sense that's outside of, like, places like Phoenix where they don't have anybody.
Yeah.
Right? And Phoenix doesn't have the money to be spending on
anything.
That's exactly it. That's why I'm suspicious of it too. So you've got those two guys in trade rumors, but I just, you know, this is second round pick territory, right? This is not anything of consequence. It's more money off the books and compile some seconds and whatever. It's not really anything.
Yeah. And seconds, yeah, maybe you use some of them, but also it's like, it's more like, hey, we got currency for when we're good again, we can trade them away for Bruce Brown, for the next Bruce Brown.
That's right. Yeah. So which of these scenarios do you think is the most realistic? A team makes an offer for Jakob Poeltl that the Raptors can't say no to. The Raptors are too good and trade Jakob Poeltl to ensure their draft position. And by too good, I don't mean obviously like playoffs. I just mean enough where they start to lose percentages. Yeah. And they're like, ooh, damn, maybe given where the season has gone and where the team looks, we want to make sure that we're below a couple of the teams that we might have a chance of jumping over. The Raptors play so poorly, they trade Jakob Poeltl as a signifier for a deeper pivot. Which of those three options do you think, if they were to trade Jakob Poeltl, actually could come to fruition?
I think number one is the likely. I don't think any of them are likely, but I think number one is the likeliest. If we weren't in the apron era, mm-hmm. where some of the teams can't aggregate salaries to make it work or it can't take on a dollar more or whatever, Jakob Poeltl should have a good market. And then, given that a couple of teams will add like a JV type between now and the deadline, some team would be like, hey, yeah, okay, we'll give you what it takes for Jakob Poeltl. We need an extra big or whatever. The number of teams that can do that and absorb, what is it, $19.5 million comfortably with all the apron stuff limits that a little bit. I still think it's the likelier one because option number two, where they're quote unquote too good, you can just shut guys down. You can, like, you're not going to be like, hey, Jakob Poeltl is fake injured for like 15 games, but you can, a guy's
a little too early in the season for that still, right?
Like, yeah, you are.
The premise here is that it's ahead of the deadline, right? Yep. So you're looking at it and saying,
and so this is why I think
trending
number three is the least likely because
they're so bad. That's number three.
But I don't know that, like, the deadline's in 4 weeks.
Yeah.
I don't know that they would make that distinction
in a month
that quickly. Yeah. And then that's a bigger conversation where RJ is maybe available as well then. Mm. And that seems more like an offseason thing. So the reason I think that they are asking for a lot if you call on Jakob Poeltl is because they intend to be not bad next year. Mm-hmm. And then Jakob Poeltl for two more years at 19.5 per is someone they would like. And like, Jakob's only 29. I know people talk about him like he's like 35 because it feels like he's been around forever. He's only 29. Like, if they want to be good again next year, like, be like fight for the sixth seed next year with, hey, you get a draft pick, you get a mid-level guy, you add to this, you fight for the sixth seed. You're not going to get better than Jakob Poeltl on the free agent market. Mm-hmm. So I understand that. So, like, if you're calling and being like, here's some salary matching and a couple seconds, they're not going to do that. Like, valuable enough. You have to come with at least a first. And I would imagine like a first where you're haggling about the protections and it's like a fairly near term first. Like, I don't think they're if Milwaukee, we'll use Milwaukee as an example. They can't make the math work, but let's say they could. And they're like 2031 first round pick completely unprotected. Mm-hmm. Then yeah. Okay. Then you start having that conversation. But I think realistically you'd be looking for a near term lightly protected first. And I don't know that that's, like, I don't know that anyone's going to get that desperate.
Again, even though through the teams, I'm like, I don't know who that is.
Yeah, and like, it's a small number of teams that could make $19.5 million work, even though that's not a huge salary. It's just, and they're going to have to walk back this apron stuff, man. They're going to have to.
It's bad. It's bad for the league. I understand why they did it, because you don't want to make player movement so easy that it becomes I think that what happened with them is that they were like, damn, player movement has become almost like above the games itself, especially when it comes to the discussions around the regular season.
But now it's like the CBA, explaining the CBA is now above the games itself. Like, Like, me well, even Mark
when a guy like Jimmy Butler
here.
Can't essentially get traded,
yeah.
you look at it and go, all right. Or a team like Denver can't make a move
yeah,
and
or
surround
Milwaukee,
Jokic.
Like yeah. they're in the Giannis is 30. Yeah. You're in the prime of his career. He's having another MVP caliber season. Mm-hmm. Like you actually like functionally can't add. It's
well, it's funny too because they did so much of this to I think counteract the Warriors.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, the Warriors' run is done, and that
and
was
they're one team that like they actually could yeah. trade for someone. They just yeah. don't want to.
Yeah. No, I mean, like, but it was yeah. Now they can do that, yeah. but during the peak of it, the yeah. fact that they were able to land Kevin Durant and yeah. then not just stop there with the team, I yeah. think probably frustrated. And that they would just continue to go into the luxury tax and use that Silicon Valley financial might that seemed endless. Up until now, what this point is with the yeah. penalties, it was like, oh, okay, well, we'll try to find a way to make it more fair for owners. And you look at it now and go, all right, now it's actually a little bit too far.
Anyway, to your question, yeah. I think a team would have to come and really move the needle
yeah.
on a Jakob trade in terms of like, what are the next 3 to 5 years look like for this franchise?
So
like
ultimately the play of the Raptors will have zero consequence from now over the course of the next month.
Not zero,
sure,
but like,
less.
It's not, yeah. Like unless they rip off a 10-game win streak. And even then, like, you could quickly, I wouldn't, but the front office could quickly be like, well, look, this is proof of concept. We could be good again next year.
Mm.
And then you're not trading Jakob Poeltl to get bad because you think you could be good again next year. That's the big thing to me is, like, if they think they can compete for, like, a high play-in to slash 5-6 seed next year, they're going to want to keep Jakob Poeltl, and you're going to have to change your mind.
Mm. We only have time for one other topic. So I'll let you pick which it is. You want to talk about your Jags or do you want to talk about Jimmy Butler?
Let's do Jags. It's
okay. So you're a Jags fan. You are one of the most famous Jags fans.
The only one.
It's like there's you and the guy from that show.
Yeah.
The fictional character.
Yeah. Bortles.
Jason, I want to say.
Yeah, that's his name, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
From Good
Mike,
Place?
Mike Jose, yeah, from Good
Place. The Good Place.
The Good Place, that's yeah. it. I thought you said Good Boys. I was like, I don't think that's the name of that show. So, yeah, Jason from The Good Place and you. You're the famous Jaguars fans. Probably Limp Bizkit. Probably Fred Durst. Like, might care somewhere. Yeah. Jacksonville native. But never really publicly behind the team.
Not, he's not wearing a Jaguars yeah, hat in all those not, music videos.
Yeah, not used enough. Did you see the clip yesterday going around of Shad Khan with Trent Baalke?
Yeah.
Where he's saying that he would fire Trent Baalke if the coach gave them a compelling reason, and Baalke's on the call. I had Brady Quinn on yesterday. He covered the final game, and he went in on Jacksonville
good.
In a way that, yeah, it's not typical for guys that are, you know, affiliated like with the NFL. Like Brady does Fox Sports. He's covering the game. And he just really went at the Trent Baalke era in terms of what they've done, the culture build, the coach. And I guess my only question for you about the Jags is like, what do you even want? Because it just seems like they are one of those teams where I don't know where you begin outside of just a complete scorched earth overhaul.
Yeah, I mean, it's an organizational rot, right?
Yeah.
Like, and I don't really understand how Baalke keeps his job through all this. Like, if I'm a coach that's coming in, if I'm a
he
coach
seems
who
to
has
be good with the power struggles because he beat Harbaugh in a power struggle.
Yeah, it's tough. Like this will be. So since he came on in 2020, and he wasn't the GM right away, but like he's been in the org in a primary role since 2020. This will be his fifth coach.
Mm.
Can you imagine other situations where a GM gets 5 coaches in 6 years and doesn't get the axe himself? And like, I don't think like he came in and getting rid of Doug Marrone was one of the things that he had to do. And then I don't think Urban Meyer was his choice. Like, I think that was a Shahid Khan decision, but Peterson was definitely his. And the roster is his, and like, I don't know. It's I don't really understand how he survived this. And like, obviously, if you're hiring a first time head coach who's a coordinator somewhere else, they probably don't have. Even if you're like Ben Johnson and you have like teams interested in you, you probably don't have the sway to be like,
you're
hey,
not getting
I need
Johnson.
Personnel yeah. decisions. But yeah, this is the thing. It's like if you hire any coach with like real name value
mm-hmm.
and they look at what Baalke's done last few, they're going to be like, I have roster.
Yeah. I think that actually has to be the Jags thing is try to get a great coach who is solid enough and enticing enough that they do get rid of the general manager.
Yeah.
And
or like he's a figurehead general manager kind of thing.
The pitch for Jacksonville to me is simple, which is, hey, not only are we going to pay you a ton of money because we've got Shad Khan, not only are you going to get to live in Florida, but you're going to be in a division where there's nothing overly threatening.
Yep.
Like the step back that Houston took this year is monumental. They haven't played a good game, what, all season? No, they beat the Bears in that game where CJ Stroud was like, you keep it up, kiddo, Caleb, and then Caleb outplayed him the rest of the year, even though Caleb's been a disaster. He's been awful, awful, awful. The Colts look completely broken and dysfunctional, and, you know, there's Ursay sitting there, and what they've got going on, it's not good. And then, who am I blanking on?
Titans, the number one pick.
First overall pick, yeah. It's like, it's, you can get back, and you do technically have Trevor Lawrence, who I think NFL people still do believe in if he's surrounded in the right
circles. And you have Brian Thomas Jr., just had one of, like, the 10 best rookie wide receiver seasons ever with Mac Jones throwing him the ball.
Like, if you're comparing it to, like, the Jets and the Bears, right? If the Jets, what's the path for you to be better than the Bills in the next couple of seasons? If you're the Bears, what's the chance of you being better than any of the three teams ahead of you in the division over the next couple of years?
It's like, all you're selling at that point is, well, you're in New York or you're in Chicago, and if it goes well, you'll be goated.
They just got to figure out this one thing, and they can actually be a thing.
The worst or second worst division. You've got the quarterback, and even if you don't like think Lawrence is a star quarterback, which I think is a fair opinion to have at this point, like he's not terrible.
You shouldn't be looking at him with great discrepancy from Caleb Williams in terms of, hey, this is a sell. Yeah, like you've got the quarterback anyway.
And like, I don't know.
Here's my actual advice to you. I wrote it down.
Is stop being a Jaguars fan?
Yeah, stop being a Jaguars.
I think I've missed the window. This is a thing where like,
it's not cute anymore.
If I was a private person, like I didn't like do shows and like post online, I could very easily do this. It would be the franchise would fold if like one third of the fan base decided, which is me, decided. Yeah,
I really do believe that there's something about that division with the two teams, particularly the Titans and the Jags, where and Houston, actually, where the jerseys are so comical, cartoonish, and not serious.
It's like they absorbed a USFL division. Like,
that they just can never get their act together, because it's like Houston fans just got the Raptors treatment, right, where it's all your playoff games have just been at 3:30 on the Saturday. Every year the league's like, we don't care that you've made it. We don't care who you have. You will be playing at 3:30 on a Saturday. And I really do believe that's not purely a Dallas thing. That's like, we can't take you seriously if you're going to come out here in those uniforms. Anyway, we got to go. Blake Murphy of the Raptor Show. You can listen to him later today in an hour. Thanks for doing this, buddy. Quick break. We'll come back to speak to Luke Fox about, what's going to happen with McCabe after his second head injury in a very short period of time. Next. The good thing about the Christmas break for me personally, outside of seeing my family, so you kind of hit like the fast forward button. You know when you'd have a franchise mode on the video game and you'd do like the skip games, simulate games? I kind of got to do that with Leafs Talk a little bit. And listen, I love what I do. There's no question about it. And I get to do it with one of my best friends ever. But yeah, it's nice to come back and be like, oh, midway mark, that stuck up. That felt quick. That felt quicker than the first quarter of the season because I did fewer games. Luke Fox, NHL on Sportsnet, joins me now. What's up, brother? How are we doing? You have a good holiday? You have a good break?
I did.
Good.
Yeah.
Good man.
It's really nice, actually, that there's 3 days where you know there's going to be no games, no news whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So, it was refreshing.
Yeah, I love that, though. That sounded so sad, really. Like, 3 whole days. You're like Charlie from the Chocolate Factory breaking up his chocolate bar and saving it over the entire year. Like, I got a whole chocolate bar for an entire year. So lucky. Anyway, we're back. So I'm going to start with this. We're at the halfway mark, so we got to ask the stock and standard question of, like, I'm not doing grades this time. I did that at... I did that at the quarter mark. I upset Mike Fiuta. He was not happy with my grades. So I'm not doing it yet.
Yeah. What did you say?
He wasn't happy that I said, I compared each kid to a type of student. And I had said that Max Domi was the kid who has potential but is not doing it, that he was out back, you know, behind the portables smoking weed. And he didn't like that. He was like, don't say smoke weed. And I was like, all right, I'll give everybody a higher grade this time around. And you know what? This is such a weird one because we're at the midway mark, and so many of the Leafs' numbers, 5-on-5, are not terrific. The goaltending has been good. It's not explaining, I think, the entire picture of why they've been able to win these close games. I do think that there is something about them now that has matured and developed, and part of that is coaching, where I have more confidence in them when it gets late and they do protect a lead. The numbers are kind of funny when it comes to 5-on-5 when they're tied. They're actually quite bad. They somehow get worse. But, so far, midway mark, biggest surprise, and then we'll do biggest disappointment.
The biggest surprise is the goaltending, I'd say. The number one in the East, number three overall in terms of team save percentage. And it was one of the biggest question marks I had coming into the season, not because anyone thought Anthony Stolarz or Joseph Woll weren't good at tending the net. It was just, can they handle the workload? Neither one had appeared in even 30 games in any of their seasons. So it was like, are they going to stay healthy? Are they, these guys who have basically been number twos, is one of them going to emerge as a one? Are they going to be able to play enough? And they've both gotten hurt, but it's been at different times. And Stolarz has been just unbelievable. And Joseph Woll's numbers are stellar too. Mm-hmm. He had a little bit of a dip there, but he's bounced back over the last week and won a bunch more games. And even Hildebeest and Murray, you know, they haven't been fantastic by any means, but neither has a losing record. So part of the credit for sure goes to a defense that is blocking more shots, that is pinching less, that is helping out their goalies. But you talk to the players, they just sound really confident in these guys, and they're getting fantastic goaltending. And it's like, when was the last time the Leafs have had the better goaltending in a playoff series? It happened once in the whole Matthews, Marner, Nylander era, and that was Samsonov over Vasilevsky, who was suddenly
hurt, which is so crazy.
Yeah, which is crazy. But the one time they actually had the better goalie in a playoff series, they won the series. So this is a really encouraging thing. You just cross your fingers about Stolarz that, you know, he gets back skating again and kind of snaps back into form after this knee operation.
So I agree with you to an extent on this one, because I didn't think the level would be this from both guys. But why I would say I'm a little less surprised than what my choice would be is I really believed in Joe Woll. I didn't love the contract extension just because of the health. Like, I thought, hey, on a balance of probability, that's always the way I am with contracts. It's not like, oh, do I think that something is going to be a horrible number? No, but I just thought, okay, what, like, let him show you that he can stay healthy and handle the workload. And then how much different is the contract going to be versus the other way around? But I always believed in the talent. There were way too many people that were either former goalies or, you know, Kevin Woodley types, Steve Valiquette types, the pure evaluators of the position that were like, no, this is a hit. Like, you're not missing on this guy if he stays healthy. So I really did believe that he could be an elite guy in the leagues. The Stolarz thing is definitely like a huge surprise in terms of how great he's been. But my pick for this is going to be John Tavares, that he's a point-of-game player. He's a point-of-game player. They took the captaincy from him. And I theorized that it would actually help with his popularity to a degree, because it would take some of the pressure off and people would view what that symbolic gesture even as a very humble move by a guy who was always stated to lead by example. But I didn't think that it was going to kind of flip to this where, so he's a point of game player, right? And he's played 40 games, but he's also leading or tied for the lead amongst all Canadian forwards when it comes to game winning goals so far this season. So he's been incredibly clutch. In the absence of Matthews, he has had difficult matchups and still put up those numbers. He was absolutely snubbed from Team Canada. And yeah, like, I don't mind that he's not going, and I understand the decision-making process. But you look at some of those guys in terms of production, like what Sam Bennett has done over the last month, and go, boy, this one's probably going to get brought up if Canada struggles to score the way that the junior team did, right? We just had kind of a dry run when it comes to this. And all of a sudden, you have Leaf fans talking about this guy. I think before the year started, maybe you disagree with this, that a lot of Leaf fans would have been like, hey, if he wants anything over a certain number, we're happy with him walking. In fact, we would be thrilled with the idea that he's gone from this organization to now someone who is probably going to get around 6.5 a year, and fans are going to be thrilled with the idea of that.
Yeah, I think that's a great guy to bring up. I'm less surprised, I think, just because talk to this guy multiple times a week, and the speech he gave at the opening of training camp, the talk the way he dealt with the captaincy transition, call it what you want, it was taken from him. And there was a determination I sensed in him that he was going to stick it to the doubters. And even back then, he was talking about how he wanted to be on that Four Nations team. I think, you know, even though his age is working against him, I think he still wants to go to Italy and represent Team Canada. That was a big reason. Like, of all the Leafs who got eliminated after that, got their hearts crushed in round one, game seven, Pastrnak, he's the only one that said, I want to play more hockey. I'm flying overseas. I'm going to wear the C for Canada. And yeah, the World Championships didn't go well, but this guy, he just loves the game. And I think he really wants to fight Father Time to the death. And a good on him. He has had a fantastic season, and particularly in that stretch, that first stretch where Matthews was out, I thought he was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And it really, I know Matthews comes back and he immediately goes back with Marner, but I hope that stretch put the idea in Brube's head that maybe, you know, if things aren't going well in a playoff series, maybe we separate Matthews and Marner, because Tavares really does play his best hockey, I think, when he's with Mitch.
Yeah. Here's the other part of it, too. He needs 10 goals to match what he had all season last year. And we're, again, 40 games in the season for him. So at the halfway mark, you know, he's already far surpassed what he did there. And so, yeah, I love the attitude. I love the approach. I'm not surprised, I guess, by the mentality stuff that you're talking about there. But, yeah, for someone who's, how old is he now, 34? Yeah, I think he's 34.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, for someone
and
who's 34.
He's doing it more five-on-five than power play. Like,
yeah.
He's getting accused of being a power play merchant. He's doing it five-on-five this year.
Yeah. No, he's been solid five-on-five. I haven't seen the power play merchant stuff. But, yeah, that's my biggest surprise. Okay, biggest disappointment time.
Biggest disappointment. To me, it's the secondary scoring, the offense in general. Whether it's 5-on-5 or power play, this is. You look at that talent. How is this not a top five or at least top 10 power play in the league?
Yeah.
So they're middle of the pack power play. That's a massive disappointment. And then, you know, 5-on-5 scoring isn't that great either. And this, despite Marner being on pace for a career year in points, Nylander, despite his recent dip, being on a career year for goals, Austin Matthews being over point a game whenever he's healthy, Tavares, we just talked about, he's exceeding expectations. So all the guys you hope to deliver are delivering, and yet you're a mediocre offensive team.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the problem? Max Domi has picked it up lately, but he got off to a horrid start offensively.
Mm-hmm.
Nick Robertson, you know, lots of hype over the camp again, but, you know, just hasn't lived up to his own expectations. Can't blame Matthew Nice. He's taken a giant step. He's been fantastic, but I don't know. They lost Bertuzzi. They've had injuries. Pacioretty's been out for a while, but they're getting hardly anything from the blue line up until this weekend.
Yep.
They just don't have a second wave, and you're still just depending on the four guys, basically, for all your offense.
Yeah.
You'd like to think the power play is going to pick up, though, in the second half.
But how many times have we said that?
Yeah.
That's the thing that is the and again, they've had regular seasons where they've been far better than what they've shown so far this year, right? Like, they finished top five on power play percentage in seasons past, and then it's dried up come postseason time. So you're a little bit more forgiving of that. But it still weirdly has always felt that despite this collection of talent, despite these guys all having worked well together 5-on-5 from a scoring chances and scoring ability, the power play just gets stuck in mud sometimes with these guys. Like, this collection of five guys, for whatever reason, despite all the talent in the world, just can't seem to click consistently on that power play. Or they just can't go without their large lulls of us talking about what exactly it is. And they've tried, you know, Mark Savard's tried to be creative in terms of putting different guys out there, and they've capitulated to William Nylander in terms of trying to get him more ice time and leave him out there for extra stuff. And Yeah, I know they didn't have Matthews, but that's when the power play was also at its best this season. So yeah, it's hard to make that. Yeah, it's like it's hard to make it as a big excuse for it. But yeah, I'm with you. That like the power play is 18th, man. It's almost like it's right beside the Calgary Flames and the Nashville Predators, who are not exactly the envy of the NHL right now. So yeah, I think that's got to be a big second half improvement. I think that one gets a little bit more grace just from the standpoint of what you said, which is you always rely on the idea that, okay, at some point they're going to heat up, they're going to get hot, and how much of this is snake bit versus anything, and I don't know. It's a tougher one to suss out. Mine is just I'm going to go with one player directly, and that's Nick Robertson. This seems really harsh because you're going like, really? The guy who was a fringe roster player is your biggest disappointment? Yeah, but simply because it was like, The smoke of the offseason, the discussion of like, hey, he's going to get traded, the whole, well, second start, second chance, the running out there yet again of this player, and for what exactly? For 6 goals over 34 games, a guy who still struggles to stay on his feet, a guy who the other night was basically benched, had a shift skip by Craig Berube in a game that has kind of been a hallmark for his success in years past, which is like a back-to-back against Philly. Not exactly the most stout team when it comes to keeping the puck out of their net. I haven't seen anything really about this guy's progression. I've just seen basically the same old thing. And at this point, like, again, you can, the argument has remained the same, which is, well, he makes 800K. So what are you going to do? And I'm like, all right, well, eventually that just can't be good enough for a team. And I just don't think it's good enough for the Leafs. Mm. And I think all of the pressure that was coming into this year and all the eyeballs that were on him and my belief after the preseason. So maybe I'm disappointed myself for believing there was going to be a step after yet another hot preseason. Cause I've done this twice now. The fact that he was compared to Max Pacioretty in terms of who would be more valuable by me, I got to at least weigh that into this decision. And so for me, it's him. It's the goal scorer who doesn't score.
It's hard for me to see him in the lineup in game one just because of
impossible.
Who is the coach, his size. He's been in and out even when some games when the Leafs have been very unhealthy and they have call-ups up and they've played over him at times. I think Brube's like the combination of McMahon, Domi, and Robertson, but I think really he's like the combination of McMahon and Domi most of all. And Robertson, you know, some more scratches are coming his way. The whole thing to me seems like an ill fit. And it's not that he's not an NHL player. I just think eventually he's going to be wearing a different sweater.
Yeah. I actually hope for his sake that it does happen this season, because I really do believe that if I was him, I'd be exhausted with this at this point. And I'd be trying to just recalibrate to thinking I need a fresh start somewhere else where there isn't a perception of me, where I can go in without any pressure and just go play. Because yeah, it's just not working here, man. And if even with that line that has shown some flashes as of late and where he was able to accumulate a bunch of his 6 goals, they've been getting caved in 5-on-5 lately. I think the last like 4 or 5 games, it's been a extremely ugly picture for them. By far the worst on the team than any other line. Okay, let's move on. McCabe gets a puck to the head, misses what, 9 days, 10 days more?
11. Yeah, 10, 11, yeah.
Okay, so he takes a puck to the head, and seemingly at the time it was like, oh, it's not a big deal, but then the Leafs did their day-to-day thing and he missed 11 days, and you're like, oh, that's probably not a good one. Now, I think he gets the concussion from hitting his head off the ice. And they haven't said concussion. They're saying upper body injury. But, like, we all know what it is. We saw him take a concussion.
Yeah. You know what? When you see it in person, it makes you sick to your stomach, yep, too. Like, when you're in the building, you see a guy try to get up and fall like
awful.
That. Like, ugh.
No, truly awful. It's one of the only things about sports that I can't stand is seeing the injuries. And especially the ones with the head because, yeah, they're harder to prognosticate. They're harder to project in terms of when you're going to be right. They've got the long-term consequences that are scary for people. But yeah, I thought that we can't really project when he's going to be back. Like, I know he was put on IR, so it's what, 10 days? How does that?
A week. So yeah, he's okay. Going to miss the next 3 games minimum. But yeah, it could be longer. Yeah.
Yeah. I would guess that after your second concussion in a month that you miss more than a week. But who knows? I'm not going to play, you know, Twitter, radio, podcast, doctor, whatever you want to call it. But I thought that the quote from Berube was interesting, and I think you did too, because you posted it and you put it out in an article. But yeah, the quote is, quote, "I didn't like it. He's sticking up for his team and his teammates. We really appreciate that, but I don't like seeing it happen," end quote. Was your interpretation of that like he doesn't like seeing McCabe fight, period, or that he didn't like what Hathaway did? Like, what was the way you interpreted it? Because I took it as like he doesn't like to see him fight.
I don't think he liked to see him fight that guy in that situation.
Yeah.
Like, it was behind the play. It's a nothing, whatever, January game against the Flyers.
Mm.
Hathaway's a real puncher, and he's probably going to face Ryan Reeves tonight, I would imagine. And I know he kind of clips Hildeby, but it didn't seem like over-the-top egregious.
Agree.
I like that. And then, you know, we want the Leafs to stick up for each other, right? We don't want the Timothy Liljegren in Boston and everyone turns the other cheek and then they have to have a big meeting about, oh, hey, guys, we're a hockey team. We need to stick up for each other. And I love that the heart McCabe showed, you know, like, okay, go have a chat with Hathaway. You have him down, but then to let him get up and actually drop the gloves. And it was a fight that McCabe picked, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like he kind of initiated it.
Not kind of, he did.
Well, he did, yeah. He did.
You
he
do
did.
That, you take multiple shots at a guy with cross checks while he's down on the ice. He's going to get up and fight you.
Yes. So I don't know. It became a bigger thing than it needed to be. And that was my interpretation from Berube. And it's a fine line, right? Because he also wants guys to stick up for each other. And he loves that. He always talks about guys being good teammates. And, you know, the whole band of brothers thing, like Berube loves that stuff. But it feels like a little bit of pick your spots or do it in a bit of a smarter way, especially since you've just had a head injury. I mean, it's a fast game, heat of the moment. I'm sure McCabe's not weighing all that in the in the thing. He just says, this guy touched my goalie, I'm going to go have a conversation with him.
Which I get, but the follow-up question to this is, do you get the sense that on a team where obviously they do preach sticking up for one another, for a group that has been lambasted at times for not doing it, that there is going to be a little bit of a discussion with McCabe of, hey, we love the tenacity that you play with. We love the way that you stick up for teammates, but you're one of the most important guys on the team. And
yeah,
we can't lose you to injury. We can't lose you for 5 minutes for a fight.
He's so important now.
Yeah.
That is one of the best shutdown pairs in hockey right now.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
He's one of the six most important skaters on the team. I now have him above Morgan Riley in terms of like guy you cannot lose to injury going into the postseason. Like taking goaltenders out of it, he's the top six skater.
He's probably harder to replace.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because Riley, you could have OEL on the power play and it'd probably be about the same. So
yeah, I would guess.
He really is an important guy. And he's behind the scenes. I know he doesn't wear a letter, but guys look up to him. He's become a leader in that room too.
Mm-hmm.
He goes about business in a different way, right? Like Tanev, I think, is a better defenseman, but he doesn't do it physically. He does it more with his stick and his shot blocking. And just the pairing of those, they really complement each other in terms of not just lefty-righty, but their style in how they defend is a little bit different. And so it's this two-headed monster that on most nights limits or completely shuts down the other team's best line. Those two guys, even though they have hardly any offense between the two of them, they lead the Leafs in plus-minus, those two. And I know, you know, plus-minus is a flawed stat, but that tells you something about just how good they are at defending. They start most of their shifts in their own zone. They kill the penalties. Like that duo is incredibly valuable, especially come playoff time. So you just cross your fingers and hope that he gets better soon. Like two head injuries in 35 days, whatever it is frightening.
he very much reminds me of Jake Muzzin in the sense of the Leafs don't have that guy who's a vocal leader in the dressing room, who is a thumper, right? Like the team, as much as they are like a more physical team, a shot blocking team, go on down the line, like how many guys actually lay the body on the team like he does, right? Nyes likes to hit. There's no question. Yeah. It's very different.
Benoit.
Yep. Benoit showcased
in his 9 minutes, whatever.
Yep.
But
ultimately, like, McCabe serves such an important, like, multifaceted function for this team. They can't afford to lose him. And I don't like that. The reason why I thought about him with Muzzin was the injury this time, where I was like, damn, that would remind me of it, where it's like you get close to the postseason and you have a guy who is getting a little bit older and plays that style where it's like he's not afraid to engage you physically, not afraid to get into a fight. The body starts to wear down. And so, yeah, for McCabe's sake and for the organization's sake, again, I feel like I'm speaking out of both sides of my mouth because I love the fact that he plays so fearless. They're going to have to preach it to him in a way that isn't fear, but more responsibility and import to the team moving forward and kind of have him be like sort of on the no-no list for fighting, especially heavyweights. Like, this is two fights against two of the better heavyweights in the league this season.
So I'll never forget. It is such a great line. Tyler Toffoli, after the bubble series that Montreal upset Toronto, and that's the one Tavares went out. He said in the Montreal room, they knew they had a great shot to win the series when Jake Muzzin went down.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't about Tavares. It wasn't about, oh, we have Carey Price. That series turned in Toffoli's mind and a lot of his teammates' mind when Muzzin went down. That's how important Muzzin was to the Leafs. Mm. And just drawing the parallel where you're talking about McCabe.
Yeah.
So
I think that
it's just a good thing it's in January. There's lots of time for him to hopefully get straight here. Yeah.
For sure. I'm not trying to like fearmonger and have people be like, oh, he's injured. Like, that's not my point here. My point is simply that it's like, you've had two head injuries in a season. If I'm the Leafs, I'm being like overly cautious in terms of his return, right? Like, I'm just pushing this. The way that they treated Matthews is the way that I want them to treat McCabe, where it's like, you're not stepping foot on the ice until you're cleared by, you know, a doctor in Germany too. You know, like we want multiple opinions that you're ready to go. But yes, just simply that the messaging is, hey man, we love the way you play. We love the way you stick up for teammates. We don't want you to lose the snarl, but we can't have you fight the Hathaways and the Shens of the world. Like, it just can't be a part of your game anymore. You're too important to this team. Like, we'll let Simon Benoit handle that. I don't care who handles it. It flat out cannot be you. Okay, so speaking of the injuries, I got to ask you about the Matthews stuff, which I don't even know what to expect from, like, an answer, where we're even really going to go with this discussion. But it's just so wild to me that he goes, he misses games again after he takes the cross check against, it was the Sabres, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So he takes the cross check against the Sabres. He misses some time. You guys get to speak with him. He mentions that, I think that he said the cross check didn't help things along the way, but also that he wasn't sure it was an injury that he was going to be able to get over during the season, but that then he comes back and he plays what I thought was one of his most complete and healthy-looking games of the season on a Saturday night shortly afterwards. Doesn't look like fatigued or beat up or slow by any stretch of the imagination against Philly on a back-to-back. So I'm like, okay, I'm pretty encouraged by this. What is your read here? What is your understanding of this? How are we meant to project this moving forward, the timeline, all of this? Because it's exhausting. It's confusing. It's a lot of different things.
My read is the player wants to play. He wants to play for the Leafs. He hates sitting back and just watching, and he wants to play in the Four Nations.
Mm-hmm.
And he's giving it as strong of a go as he can. He doesn't want to take days off or games off. I wouldn't be surprised if we see some maintenance days and he skips some practices, though, as they try to manage it. So he's indicated that rest helps whatever this ailment is. So Berube is, I think, going to limit his minutes a little bit, although, you know, you're coaching in a one-goal game, and almost every Leafs game is a one-goal game these days. you get tempted, you throw him out 6-on-5, and but Brube's going to try and limit his minutes a little bit more. I think they're going to take it a bit easy on practices, but Matthews wants to push through the pain here a little bit, the discomfort, and fans are probably going to be on the edge of their seat every time he takes a cross check or a hard hit. But I am encouraged by what I saw this weekend.
I'm encouraged too.
Surprised how good he looked. Yeah. I was a little surprised how good he looked.
Impossible not to be surprised. Again, he did the smart move, which was to set the bar low, talking about how he wasn't sure he'll get over the injury during the season, and then coming out and looking his absolute best, because we all had to basically recalibrate our expectations on the fly watching him in that game. It's just, this will still bother me, and whatever, everyone's entitled to their opinion, and if he's healthy enough throughout the stretch, then I guess it is what it is, and he goes and plays for the Four Nations. I just, the thing you mentioned there, the second part where you go, like, and he really wants to play in the Four Nations, yeah, everyone should, right? Like, I want all players to want to play in the Four Nations. I want all players to have the drive to want to play for their country. But for an injury that does require rest, an injury that does need to be mitigated, an injury that might not heal over the course of a regular season, I just hope that that none of the timeline has to do with having enough of a runway ahead of this tournament to justify the decision to go. Because that to me is actually the scary outcome if you're invested in the Leafs.
What if he plays every game from now up until the tournament?
I mean, you can't say no. I've put my stake in the ground on this. I think that if rest and recovery is going to have a real meaningful impact on him, which I think we can say conclusively it does, especially given the way they've handled it, but also the way that this whole thing even started, which was when the Leafs had their lull in the schedule, right? In November or December? No, it was November. Their lull in November, where they had like 3 games in 12 days or whatever. The big talking point was, this is awesome because we can skip a few games for Matthews and he essentially ends up getting 2 weeks of rest without missing any games. It's just, it's hard for me to understand, as if I'm just putting on like Leaf fan shoes, it's hard for me to understand how the captain of the team would make the decision to go play for his country ahead of putting his team first, given the injury. Like, if he gets hurt at that tournament, I've said it and I'll say it again, it will irreparably alter his perception in the city forever, and unless he wins the Stanley Cup.
Yeah, but, you know, it's an if. The tournament is 3 or 4 games.
Yep.
That's it. And this is a proud American.
Mm-hmm.
And there will be pressure from U.S. hockey and from Gary Bettman. You know, he's one of the faces of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So if he's healthy, he's playing, or health, if he's good, healthy, if he's 80% healthy, whatever he is right now, he's playing.
Don't love it. I just can't. And this has nothing to do with the Canadian thing. I would genuinely be saying the same thing if it was Mitch Marner. Like, if it was Mitch Marner and this was the exact situation, I would be going, you cannot go, you cannot go, you cannot go. The only difference is that I genuinely believe there's an added emphasis to being the captain of the team, having just taken on this role this year, and yeah, showing your group, like, leading by example and saying, like, I'm not good to go. I know what the stakes are here, and they're far greater than winning the Four Nations tournament for the Americans. Like, I'll get them next year in the Olympics anyway. Only a couple more for you. I want to ask you about Philip Myers. So he gets this contract extension. It's kind of a nothing burger in terms of risk, right? It's like 800K, same thing. Like, okay, 2 years of a guy who's right shot D, who's big. What is your understanding, though, of the internal view of this player?
They like him.
Yeah.
And the coach especially. So Trey Living and Brube are aligned in that they love their defenseman big, right? There's mm-hmm. a big righty, whatever. He has the right attitude. That's the other thing. You talk about this guy, and he's like, he's just thrilled to be here. And it's usually a guy that gets healthy scratched and barely plays for the first 2 months of the season. You sense frustration from him, and that's not the case with him. So I think he has the right attitude to be 6, 7, 8, whatever it is. Pop in, pop out. And Brube's a big fan. And I think he loves the fact that he doesn't hesitate to shoot it. You know, he doesn't have a goal yet, but he plays the way Brube wants guys to play, which is a little bit physical and just simple. Like, you get the puck at the point, blast it, and hope for the best. And my sense from the player is he's been, you know, he's turned into a bit of a journeyman, like fringe guy. The fact that there's actual term on this deal, he was thrilled. He's like, they're going to give me 2 years? Great. Mm-hmm. Even though it's less than $1 million. And it's very low risk. And injuries to defensemen happen all the time. So I think it's fine. It's fine. And it's going to look even better when the cap goes up. And even if he has to spend some time in the Marlies or up in the press box, it's not going to hurt you. I think it's fine.
No, I think it's fine. I wonder if they think he can be a Benoit, where there's like a little bit more than what the, like, you're trying to, are you trying to win on this contract, or are you looking at this contract as just simply, this is what he is. He's 800K player. And if we get that, that's all we really want from out of this.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it also keeps guys like Connor Timmins honest. Like, mm-hmm. Connor Timmins had a nice stretch of hockey. He dipped a little. Someone's yeah. coming for his job. I think that's a really good thing to have on agree. The edges of your lineup.
I agree. You
know, yeah.
I agree, but I also want to see it at the top of the lineup too sometimes. You know, like when William Nylander stays out for a 4-minute yeah. shift, you're like, hey, yeah. there's going to be some discussion about this. I love the accountability stuff, but there's a reason for the saying, and I believe in Australia, is like accountability sounds at the top. And so if the internal competitions and the accountability only comes at the bottom of the roster, I think you have no accountability at all. So at some point this year, I do hope we get one of those moments where it's like, hey, we're checking the big guys too.
There was a really small one. So, you know, Nylander was playing PP1 and PP2.
Yeah, I know.
A couple games back, they made a switch and had he threw Marner out for the extra PP2, and they actually scored. So,
all it took was an entire season of Nylander never scoring on the second unit.
He's in one of his funks, but he'll snap out of it.
Yeah, 7 games without a goal for Nylander. So, yeah.
Well, look at some of the centermen he had for some of those games, though.
Yeah.
Holmberg and Kampf. I don't know.
Yeah. Hey, don't disrespect David Kampf. Don't throw him in the mix with this Holmberg. That's, I won't accept that. I won't have it. Luke, really appreciate your time as always, buddy. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Take care, buddy. Thanks for having me on.
Luke Fox, NHL on Sportsnet. I still haven't had enough of an experience with Phil Myers to really have a strong opinion one way or the other, but I actually did think that he stepped up and played well in the Philly game the other night, that he made a few just smart, simple, easy plays. That is what you want to see from a guy like that. Again, the question is, do you win on the contract, or did you just have the contract? The Matthews stuff, I understand it's probably frustrating to some. I would understand that it would be frustrating to him, but again, like, you're the captain. You're the captain of the Leafs. I know it's 3-4 games. Sends a pretty powerful message to your group if you tell them that something you want that badly, you're willing to sacrifice for the greater good of your team. Like, that's what sacrifice is. It's not like taking off the odd night of a back-to-back. It's losing something you covet for the benefit of not just yourself, but others. And so, yeah, even if he looks healthy all the way up to the Four Nations, I'm not going to be a fan of it. There's just not going to be something between now and then that is going to convince me that this is what's good for the local hockey team, which ultimately I make no apologies for caring more about than USA hockey at this tournament. I like how Canada's going to play the United States, though, and I'm going to be like, this means everything to me. And to Matthews, I'd be selling this as like, this is the fake tournament. This is the COVID Cup. Like, don't you ever be taking this seriously. Make sure you're not there, blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, I recognize I'm being a little hypocritical. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at JD Bunkus. Reach out anytime. Subscribe to the podcast. It really helps. That's what really helps the show. Let's take a quick break and hit what we missed.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
New intern. Christian. How do you say your last name? Because when I say it, sounds racist.
Chiniti.
Yeah, there you go. Just so everybody knows, when I do it, I'm not trying to zhuzh it up. That's how he likes it. Chiniti. Woodbridge guy. Welcome to the show, buddy. What do you think you're qualified to do here, would you say? Anything?
You know, I think I know my Leafs. I think that's where my qualifications begin.
Okay, give me a take.
Take. I like the McCabe-Muzzin comparison. I did. That was my immediate
thought,
take. Too.
That's a commentary on my opinion.
Did not feel good
opinion.
Seeing McCabe try to get up there.
No one thought it was good to see. All right, what a Leafs guy. Just heard what I said and regurgitated it. What a take. What an original. That's your thing. Got it. You had a shot. That was your shot at the big leagues. You didn't get prep. That's the thing, dude. Hard work meets opportunity, right? You work hard in the shadows. You get an opportunity like that. Be ready. Like my boy Armin.
That was very much like, sell me this pen.
Yeah, it was. Sell me this pen. I ain't buying that pen, dog. Like, that pen is staying in your pocket. Christian Chinetti. Anyway, welcome to the show. He seems like a good kid. All right, Armin, Mike, what did we miss?
All right. Do you want to start with the Meek Robertson or do you want
actually,
to go
no,
way?
I want to start with the Vladdy thing.
Okay, so Bob Nightingale had an article this morning on USA Today, and he spoke briefly about Vladdy and the Blue Jays, and I'm quoting this directly from the article. Vladdy Jr. and the Blue Jays are $100 million apart, with Guerrero seeking at least $450 million. Mm. If Guerrero doesn't receive an extension by spring training, he'll test free agency. If Guerrero doesn't return to the Blue Jays, he would love to be with the Red Sox, friends say, which may be why the Red Sox are hesitant in their pursuit of Alex Bregman.
A couple things here. If you're the Blue Jays, you already know that Vladdy is not negotiating in season, or at least he's saying as much. And here's what I would say. Is there no scenario where the Jays can go to him with a monster bag of money and say, will this get it done in season? Sure. But generally speaking, I believe the player here, especially once you get to that point and free agency is so close for him, the idea that it's going to cost you less doesn't seem plausible or realistic, right? Like, let's play this out in the sense of, okay, so Vladdy and the Jays don't come to an agreement by the beginning of spring training. He has a down season. The Blue Jays still come over the top and they say, like, he's not having a good year. It's halfway through the season, he's not having a good year. And the Blue Jays come to him and they go, all right, we know you wanted $450 million. Let's say that's the price, because he says at least $450 million. My interpretation of that is automatically it's more than $450 million, right? You're 100 apart. You've offered him $350. He's having a down year. How does it make more sense for you as an organization to go to him with the 450 at that point? You think that the 350 is going to get it done? Like, you think more time is still, like, in some way going to work for you in terms you're going to get a discount? No. Okay. So, and if for him at that point, do you really think he's going to view it as a life raft? Or do you think he's going to be looking at it more through the lens of, well, why wouldn't I just wait at this point anyways, given that I'm a few months away from free agency and I can see what other teams have to offer me. And I understand that having a bidding war is likely going to be nothing short of good for me, basically regardless of the outcome. I'm buying this. I don't see any reason not to believe in this. My only other thought on it would be, even if the Red Sox get Bregman, I don't view that as like a complete disqualifier that they would be out on Vladimir Guerrero Jr., even given the history of the Red Sox recently, where it's like they've been cheap and they moved off of Mookie Betts for money purposes and they've been disappointing fans, much like Blue Jays fans, like year over year with what the free agency spends have been. I would be suspicious that that would like completely take them out of the mix, even though they would have Bregman and Devers, which would make the fit potentially uncomfortable.
And to my knowledge, Vladdy's never gone through the process of like meeting with other teams.
Well, no, he hasn't.
And like, I'm sure he wants to do that before he's like out of his prime, just even the process.
To your knowledge?
Yeah. To my knowledge. You know, to your knowledge. A little yeah. disclaimer.
It's like how unrestricted free agency works and
just
contracts.
In case.
Yeah. Sorry, good. Yeah. Don't try to sell me any pens on this.
He's the show's insider.
I was going to say, wow, Arden is reporting. Oh, God, I just did it again. Armin's reporting that Vladdy has not met with any other teams while he has not been legally allowed to do so.
So, but now with this spring training report, it seems like there's a deadline. Like now we're ticking. Like
yeah,
the
of
bomb's
course.
Ticking.
It is ticking. And here's my optimistic spin on this, that this stuff coming out about the Vladdy number does show you that, like, he wants to come back here. Like, the player putting it out there of, like, what his demand is, in a weird way, is, like, a good sign for Blue Jays fans. Does that make sense? Like, there's a number that can get it done. And to me, it's just not that outlandish, given what the stakes are here for the future of the organization, and also the idea that this is a good way to negotiate, is to put it out there, though, that it's like, if you don't sign me, I'll go to one of your rivals and make things even worse for you. Like, I'll be there as a constant reminder, making things worse. So, I don't know. This is a tough one to interpret, like, in terms of all of the legitimacy of it, but you'd get it from his negotiating standpoint. But if he was doing it that way, that would be an indicator that, like, he wants to get something done before spring training. So, that's how I'm going to choose to view it. All right, what's next?
Yeah, all right. Now, do you want to go to Amik Robertson, or do you want to do something else?
Yeah, well, I just want to play this audio because I love it, and I want it to be a part of the show. So Amik Robertson, he's the Lions cornerback that held Justin Jefferson to essentially nada, right? You don't know whose name is. You know, you guys have never heard of him. I had never heard of him. I did not know who Amik Robertson was.
Played for the Raiders for 3 years.
Yeah, awesome. had never heard of his name before, had no idea who he was, but he held Jefferson to, I think, 2 catches on 6 targets, like completely blanketed him, right? And this goes down for me in the pantheon. Have you guys heard this quote before? Like, have you ever heard anybody use that?
No.
Is this from like
it was
a
Wicked?
Is this, like, I was going to say, is this from a song?
This is not authentic, though. I think I've heard, I can't tell you where I've heard it, but I feel like I've seen it before, I will say.
Okay, well, either way, I want to play it because I'm stealing it from now on till the end of time. So he gets the game ball from Dan Campbell. That's the situation here. Because, again, he shut down the best receiver in football. Like, either the first or the second, it's either him or Ja'Marr Chase. Like, you know, splitting hairs between the two of them. But either way, so he delivers this speech.
I mean it from the bottom of my heart, man. I appreciate y'all, man, because y'all gave me a chance to showcase what I could do when they tried to bury me, dog. But they can't bury what come from the dirt. Hey, let's get that big one, man. Let's keep on working, man. I love y'all. Appreciate y'all.
So, yeah, this guy was a 4th-round pick with the Raiders, and he spent a bunch of years there really unceremoniously. Like, he really didn't do much. He started 12 games for the Raiders in the final season. Then he comes to Detroit this year, and he's only started 4 games. So he's not exactly Mr. Pedigree or Mr. Needed, but they can't bury what comes from the dirt is the new slogan of this show. See you tomorrow.